Snowflake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. If the title, The Geography of Madness, weren't enough to grab your attention, the subtitle would probably do it. Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. The book, by writer Frank Burris, is part travelogue and part meditation on the way culture works.
Burris started looking into so-called culture-bound syndromes like, yes, penis theft, while he was living in Madison. The Minnesota native now lives in the Twin Cities, where he joins us via Skype to explain the nature of culture-bound syndromes and to talk about the questions he was seeking to answer. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
One of the really interesting points you make in this book comes when you write that language is not the only doorway into people's stories and secrets, just the first one. And, you know, I think the same could probably hold true for mental illness. So why, of all the doorways into culture, did you find mental illness such a compelling doorway?
Well, when you look at the so-called cultural syndromes or culture-bound syndromes, it's, for me, that's interesting because it's where you can most obviously see how a culture affects us and shapes the way we think the world should go and the way our lives are going. And it's a good place to look at how the world comes together in our minds and then how that can go wrong and how it can go right.
Well, and I'm interested in what seems like the kind of formative story that really got you thinking about our place in culture, and that was your trip to Italy at the, I guess it was the end of high school. Why was that such a formative experience?
Well, it was just, I didn't have a lot of experience. Globalization hadn't really started. We didn't have a huge amount of exposure to other cultures and other people and other ways of thinking and doing things. And so, you know, I grew up in Winona, Minnesota, which is a smallish town. And, you know, our horizons were pretty small. The way you thought things should go, the way you thought you should look, all seemed like sort of set in stone. And then to get out into the world, and I lived in Bologna, Italy, it's small things to find out that there's different ways of eating and dressing and spending time with people, and, you know, time flows sort of differently. And, you know, all these things added up to something really powerful, and sort of to be able to feel how culture can shapes us on levels that we don't really understand.
Yeah, and I was fascinated that essentially what it sounds like happened was when you left, you got to Italy and you didn't really feel like you fit well there. And then you came back to Winona for a time and then you didn't feel like you fit in there. And by the time you got back to Italy, you felt like you fit in there much more.
Right. Yes, exactly. I mean, things started making more sense when I went back. I was there for a few months and it was just like sort of devastating culture shock, like the kind where you just like lay in your bed and stare at the ceiling. And then I went home for Christmas and nothing had really changed at home, but like I felt like I had changed somehow, you know, and you don't really have any idea what's going on at that age and, you know, at the time until you think about it later. But then I went back to Italy and for some reason things started to click more. I got the language, things just made more sense in a way that they didn't before.
Well, and so then let's get to the meat of this book, which, you know, the major issue that you went looking for was this phenomenon known in some cultures as Koro, which I guess I should have you describe.
Yeah, so Koro is what is called by a lot of people cultural syndrome or culture-bound syndrome, and it's a condition where people feel like their genitals are being sucked into their body, and if that happens, they will actually die. And in some, depending on the sort of stories that that's part of, if enough people kind of believe that or believe in the forces behind that, then it can actually become like an epidemic and spread from person to person. And so that's essentially what it is. And it looks a little different in different cultures, but it's the core of it is kind of similar.
Right. You first ran across it in Nigeria, but it turns out to be an issue in many parts of the world.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's sort of most spectacular in Nigeria, just because it's combined also with like some mob justice, but it happens also in Benin and Congo, and in Asia. Historically, it was kind of considered a something that happened in China and Indonesia and those sort of places, and that's become like less prominent there, but sort of more prominent in Africa for, you know, whatever reason.
Well, and colloquially, it gets referred to as penis theft. And
right, yes.
What seems different about in Nigeria, as you describe it, you can actually find people blaming neighbors for doing this, whereas the experiences you encountered in China were ascribed essentially to a ghost.
Yeah, it wouldn't be neighbors like that, you know. It would be like somebody nearby, you know, or somebody right. that you like. In when it happens in the north, or historically when it's happened in the north, it's been like foreigners who are blamed. Or one time it happened in a town in central Nigeria, and it was like evangelicals who were going door to door who kind of got blamed. And so it can take on that dynamic, but it's but yes, usually somebody who it happens to will feel like their penis, sometimes actually sometimes women too, but usually men, feel like their genitals have been stolen magically, and then they'll look around for who did it.
And of course, this comes in, you know, despite evidence to the contrary, you know, that their genitals are still there.
Yes. I mean, usually that's the next question, you know, can't they just check or whatever? And the short answer is no, because it's not like a visual thing. It's like it's a feeling thing, you know, and so they really feel like it's gone. And if you have that sort of strong belief, it doesn't matter what you tell somebody. And a lot of them will go to the doctor, and then the doctor will say, oh, you're fine, you know, and then they will say, no, that's, you know, it's not really mine, or it's mine's bigger than that, or, you know, the essence is gone, or something, some explanation for why that's not true. And so, you know, there's a little bit similar to, you know, telling an anorexic person that they should just get on the scale and see how much they weigh. You know, it doesn't matter that much what you tell them if they don't believe it.
Well, and so what makes this a good case study for the questions that you were trying to explore?
What makes it a good case study is that it's got a pretty clear link to the stories that people tell and the stories that people believe. And that was kind of my the thing I was looking into, is how culture is like this ecosystem of stories that we're part of, and it shapes the way that we think things can go and the way that we think things should go and shouldn't go. And so, you know, you can see that pretty clearly in the Nigerian Koro situation, where everybody has stories about this. The narrative, like, ecosystem is pretty rich with these possibilities, to the point that nobody really doubts that this kind of thing is possible. It's just the reality.
What was the part of the story that you felt essentially locked out from?
Well, as an outsider, you can't really be a participant in these things. Like, nobody would ever think that I could, you know, manipulate magic. It would take a high level of integration and immersion and trust to be able to be, like, really part of these kind of stories. And so you're always sort of looking out and trying to imagine what it's like from the inside.
So essentially, you can speak the language or have access to the language, and you can understand the culture. But if you are not of the culture, the culture-bound syndromes aren't your syndromes.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Which is why it's so easy to see. Which is why other people's look so weird and ours don't. Ours look like perfectly normal.
Well, right. And so, to that end, you know, for people who might think that, well, this is crazy, you know, the idea of penis theft, essentially, what are the culture-bound syndromes that exist in this country that people don't necessarily think of in those terms?
The things that I looked at were, you know, the one that a lot of people talk about is premenstrual syndrome. You know, it doesn't exist in a lot of places, or it exists in a different form. You know, women across the world have different kinds of symptoms. You know, like in Hong Kong and China, they'll report sensitivity to cold, which American women don't have. You know, there's also, I looked at carpal tunnel syndrome, which kind of rises and falls in history and in different forms. And so that was that was interesting to see how something that seems so mechanistic actually does have a cultural element to it, or a kind of narrative element to it.
It was interesting to see that it existed among telegraph operators under a different name more than a century ago.
Right, exactly. And then before that, among people who clerical workers who had Scrivener's palsy, which was basically the same thing almost, which came for a while, especially when the technology is new or something's changing or this is just kind of generalized anxiety. It seems to go up and then people sort of forget about it and it goes away.
You did raise an interesting question. In fact, a lot of people sort of raise this, whether education is the enemy of culture. Why is that a critical issue?
When you bring this topic up, that's kind of one of the first things that people say, is that these old cultural syndromes are disappearing because people are educated and they know better now. And I think that's a little bit of a misreading. I mean, that's kind of like an old understanding of cultural evolution, like that there was these kind of more primitive beliefs that are based in kind of ignorance and superstition, and then gradually humanity moves forward to a clearer, more rational view of things, which is that's our culture, and that's what we feel like we are, and we feel like our syndromes are all perfectly, rational and biological, when in fact a lot of them have elements of culture and belief, mixed in with the biology.
So you did an interview with your publisher as the book was coming out, and you were given the question, what was the most surprising place you found? And your first answer was Wisconsin, which really only has a bit part in this book because you lived in Madison for a while. Was there more to your answer than that brief response?
I was a little bit joking. Wisconsin is surprising for a lot of reasons, one interesting thing about living in Wisconsin is, compared to Minnesota, where I grew up. I mean, I grew up in Winona, so it's kind of on the border of the two places. So, I'm familiar with Wisconsin. I went to kindergarten in Madison, and so it's not that much different from Minnesota, but you can see some differences in the German background and the accent and things like that. And one thing I always liked about Wisconsin was the amount of sort of outsider art there is, like the Forevertron and Baraboo and the House on the Rock and San Filippo's squirrel diorama and all these weird things where people have kind of created these little worlds for themselves.
Have you been to the Fred Smith Concrete Park in Phillips?
I know about it. I have not been up there yet, but yes, I would love to go there. Have you been there?
I have. It is it is difficult to find the right words.
I know. I love that kind of stuff, and it's really interesting to see these individuals who have really created their own little universe, and then these sort of art things kind of grew out of it. Like the Forevertron was probably the best example. He had an actual storyline that he felt like feels like he's part of. All these machines sort of grew out of, and I love that kind of thing.
You have, if I am correct, a couple of fairly young daughters, I think.
Yes.
How did you handle the idea that Dad is writing a book about penis theft with them?
Oh, they're well versed in these sort of things. I don't really hide it from them. They know more about penis stealing than most kids their age.
But have you done career day at school?
No, not yet. Not yet. Or take your kid to work day.
Let me ask you a strange, but in all seriousness, question, and that is, as you sort of homed in on people who were closer and closer to this phenomenon, it's not that there are spoilers in this book, but was there some part of your psyche that knew that without being able to experience this phenomenon yourself, there was no perfect way to get at it?
I know there's no way you can be part of someone else's culture, and what my hope was just to be able to get close enough to kind of see things from the inside, not to actually be inside. If that's your question, I didn't really think I was going to become a Nigerian, you know, or whatever, become immersed in Chinese culture. That would take years and years and years.
Well, it is really a pretty compelling story and surprising in many ways. So, Frank Burris, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and congratulations on the book.
All right. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Frank Burris's new book is called The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. Burris started the research on his book while he lived in Madison. He now lives in Minnesota. You'll find a link to more about the book at WUWM.com.